Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 117 of The Psych Files, the world of psychology in everyday life. Michael Britt here, host of The Psych Files, and this episode will be on obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now, we have a very interesting interview with a young woman named Bobby who has agreed to talk about her OCD. Now, I've been wanting to do an episode on this topic, and Bobby contacted me perhaps a year ago with a very interesting question. She said, you know, why is it that OCD is, people seem to be at ease making fun of it? But you don't make fun of other kinds of problems. We don't make fun of people with schizophrenia or depression. And yet you do see a lot of characters on TV who seem to be obsessed with, or we make sure we get that differentiation corrected. The obsessions have to do with thoughts, and the compulsions have to do with behaviors. And so you see a lot of characters on TV who need order in their lives, and why is it that we're okay with that, and we even laugh at that, but we don't for other disorders? So we talk about that in the course of this interview with Bobby. So I want to thank her, first off, for coming on and agreeing to do the interview. She's quite active at her college, University of Texas, and letting people know about OCD. What is it? People are curious. And she does some blog entries. She participates in some support groups as well. So I think you'll find lots of information in this episode and on the website as well. I'll have links to some books and articles. Afterwards, I wanted to talk about two really interesting articles which may provide the beginnings of a neurological explanation for OCD. So hang in there for that. And here we go. Let's do the interview with Bobby. Let me just start with a few questions, and let's see where we go from there. All right, sound good?
All right.
Since OCD encompasses both obsessional thoughts and compulsive behaviors, tell us a little bit about what you experienced.
Well, I've kind of run the gamut of symptoms. I started out doing mostly checking, and I had obsessional thoughts. Once you kind of get a handle on one symptom, it comes back with a new one. Ordering, it's always been a big one for me, ordering and cleaning.
Ordering?
Things have to be straight and in the right order. I alphabetized, got alphabetized bookshelves and CDs. Things need to be straight. They can't be crooked, and they should be lined up.
Yeah, so now all of us have experienced the, you know, did I turn the stove off kind of thing. But what is the difference between me wondering about whether or not I turned the stove off and what you do?
Well, you might wonder that you'd turn the stove off and you'd go back and check it once, and then you'd know it was off. For me, I would go back and check it, and then I'd leave, and 5 minutes later, I'd think, maybe I didn't really turn it off. Maybe I missed it the second time, and that would just continue. I might check the stove 25 times and never really be sure that I turned it off. At the same time, I would know I had turned it off, but I would feel I hadn't, and that's where the disconnect is. It's in the feeling.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. There's other kinds of things that you check?
Well, I don't do the stove so much. It's door locks.
Door locks.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll leave my house and think, did I lock the door? Maybe I should go back and check the door. For the most part, I've got that one under control, but every once in a while, I still have to turn around and make sure, and you follow a ritual, and if you follow the ritual, then most of the time, you're okay. 3 checks on the way out, and then you can get in the car and go.
Do you have like a list that, and then once you stand at the door and check the lock, you check that off? Is that what you do?
It's a mental list, but pretty much, yeah.
All right, so you.
I have trouble getting out of my house if I don't do something. You know, if I don't do things in the right order.
Mm-hmm. Now, those are both obsessional thoughts and compulsive behaviors there.
Right.
All right, so let's start with when this started then, because I'm curious about when, how old were you? Did either you or your parents realize that maybe this is more than just being a worried person?
Well, I got, in retrospect, I can see symptoms in myself as early as 3. I love to sing, and I've got video of singing songs with my parents, but if my parents would mess up a word, I have to stop and go back and start over again. And I would do that as many times as it took for them to get it right. I don't think anyone realized that early. I know that as young as 5 and 6, I was doing checking behaviors, but again, I didn't realize, and people with OCD are so good at hiding I was probably 11 before anyone noticed that things were a little bit over the top.
Have you asked your parents and said, did you notice anything in me?
Well, I started having panic attacks when I was 11, and I think that's when we all realized that maybe there was a little more to it. I was going through a period of scrupulosity. Now, scrupulosity is religious obsession, feeling that if you do something wrong, you need to go back and atone for it, and that you'll never really be good enough.
Uh-huh. Okay. Would it be shaky feelings, sweating, you know, something like that?
Panic attacks are rapid heartbeat, inability to breathe, shaking, sweating, and nausea. They're so varied in terms of symptoms. They can be different for everyone that has them.
What other kinds of symptoms have you heard?
Dissociation is a big one, feeling like nothing that's happening is real. And that feeling triggers panic. For some people, they don't get the rapid heartbeat, but they feel very sick and they get cold. There are so many different symptoms.
That's interesting. So you were having these panic attacks around 11.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, were the obsessional thoughts coming along with it?
No, they usually triggered panic attacks. I would have the obsessional thought, and then I would become so upset and worked up that I would start the panic. And eventually, the panic kind of took on a life of its own.
So sometimes you'll have panic attacks without any thought.
Right.
So you're 11, and at that point, your parents are aware that there's an issue here. What was their approach?
We really didn't know anything about OCD, so we just kind of dealt with it within the family. I didn't go into therapy until I was 16, and then it was my idea.
So did they seek out some medication for you then? How did they try to help you?
Well, like I said, mostly we talked, and they would try to explain to me that things weren't really so bad. And once again, you know, you hide your symptoms with OCD. You realize that something's not quite right, and you don't want people to know about it, even the people who are closest to you.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't see a lot of what I was doing, and I certainly didn't tell them all of what I was thinking. They only saw what I wasn't able to hide. By the time I was 16, I could no longer hide symptoms anymore, and then I realized that something was wrong. It's really confusing until you know what it is. You don't understand, why am I having these thoughts? I know that they're irrational. I know that they don't make any sense. And you think that you should be smart enough or strong enough to just stop having them. And that's not really the case. But you're afraid that other people will think, well, why don't you just stop?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to have to deal with explaining that.
On your campus, you've already got, what, going a support group and a website?
I help facilitate the local support group, the citywide support group. I came in, I guess, a couple of years ago, and I've been there so long now. I'm one of the younger members there, so I try to help reach out to the other younger people in the community. It's intimidating to go into a support group where everyone's twice your age. I'm trying to start a campus chapter of that, and you know, I'm working with Services for Students with Disabilities on campus. They're really great. Getting all the paperwork done and getting the awareness out there so I can get enough people to start the group. But I've been given the opportunity to write a blog for the school, and I talk about OCD. I don't do every entry on OCD, but I've done a couple specifically about it, and the more work I do towards getting the support group going, the more I find myself talking about it.
So you have a bunch of other kids at college who are on this group with you?
Well, I've met a couple. But once again, OCD tends to be something that you don't talk about. You hide it. You don't want people to know. So finding people is a little bit of a challenge. But statistically, there should be almost 1,000 people there who have OCD.
Yeah, I'm seeing some numbers. Well, here's the numbers I'm finding on this. 3.3 million people are diagnosed with it. Let's see, 2.5% of the population between ages 18 and 54.
Right. So about 2%, we should have hundreds, if not at least 1,000 members.
So speaking of other students, then, you sent me some really surprising question. So here's one, and you say you get this. Quote, you look normal. So why are you getting accommodations, you know, these special services? And that's, you know, that reflects not just OCD. I mean, that just reflects a lot of people's attitudes in general. examine that thought a little bit. You say, well, how am I supposed to look? How are people with depression supposed to look? How are schizophrenics right. supposed to look? But tell me, how what's your reaction to that, and how do you respond to it?
Well, I usually just I try to explain that it's not something that you can always see. I really just try to educate. That's my main goal, is for more people to understand it, because I don't think that people who ask that question do so maliciously. I think they just don't really understand.
Yeah, and then there's that sort of black and white thinking where we, students who take introductory psych, the first thing that the teachers try to get them to understand when we get to this section of the book is that the things that they're going to talk about are all along a continuum, that all of us, for example, get depressed, we get sad, you know, some of us stay in it longer than others, some of us experience very little of it, and all of us have a certain degree of checking and cleaning behaviors and things like that.
Right. I've also found that I don't tell everyone that I'm receiving accommodations. You have to protect yourself and be careful about who you're disclosing to and why you're disclosing. Because there are some people that just won't get it. And there's no reason to set yourself up to be hurt or talked to as if you're doing something wrong. I don't really go into it with strangers. I have to know someone before I'll fully explain it. And usually by that time I understand, well, okay, you're going to accept it or you're not going to accept it. Well, the only exception to that would be with my professors, because I have accommodations that I have to give them letters about, and I have to explain, well, I get extra testing time, and I'm allowed to leave the room. And, you know, it runs a continuum. Some of them really understand it, and some of them don't have any idea what OCD is. But for the most part, I've gotten really good responses.
Interesting. They don't know what OCD is. Wow.
Yeah, I did. I ran into that last semester, and it really surprised me that one of my professors just said, well, what does that mean?
Huh, okay. Well, I guess that's just because I'm in psychology and I've heard it for so long. It is funny how we, you know, you don't see, I mean, at least I don't think so. I don't watch a whole lot of television, but you don't see characters on TV who are depressed or schizophrenic. But people who are perfectionistic, you see that a lot.
Right, but a lot of the time they don't name it. Look at a show like Friends, for example. You've got a character in, Monica, I don't know if you've watched this, but you've got a character in this show who is so obviously has obsessive compulsive characteristics, but they're not going to name that. It's a comedy. They want to use it for the laugh factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Isn't that odd? Why does it seem safe for the media to... and I guess what jumps to my mind would be when I... was it the movie The Incredibles? Did you see that movie?
I didn't, even though you told us we all should.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great movie because mostly it's about self-esteem. But Jack Paar, Mr. Incredible, he you know, in the beginning of the movie, he has a job, an insurance agency, and you know, his boss is you know, depicted as unreasonable and all this. But one of the things that his boss does, they take the time to show him lining up his pencils with the lines mm-hmm. in his calendar on his desk. And so it's as if that is one of the cues that the writers give you that this guy isn't quite right. So why is it okay? I don't know. I think that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think I asked you that question. That was my initial question to you, is I wondered, because, you know, shows like Monk, they're realistic to a point. And I think Monk's actually received a lot of awards. But at the same time, you watch it, it's a comedy. It's there because people think it's funny. And you're right, you never see that. You never see the funny autism show. You never see funny depression. And I wonder sometimes why it's okay. I really don't have an answer, other than I suppose, even in hindsight, I can look back at my behaviors and say, well, yeah, that was a little out there. But at the time, of course, someone going through washing or checking or ordering, it's not funny, and it's certainly not fun.
So I'll throw that out to the listeners and ask them to comment on the blog, you know, why they think that it seems to be okay. I'm wondering, as we speak, I wonder if it has to do with the fact that we can, that most people can identify with it, right? How many people can identify with schizophrenia? Probably not. And most people still don't get the difference between schizophrenia and multiple personalities. But everybody has had the experience of being overly worried and concerned and maybe at some point checking things repeatedly. I don't know. Well, that may be part of the reason.
I think you might be right.
All right. Well, let me just ask you a couple more questions then. And let me ask what you recommend if someone's listening and thinks that, well, you know, I think I do more than just check things. I think I might really kind of have an issue here. What do you suggest?
Well, the first thing I'd recommend is read. Read everything you can find about OCD. Knowledge for this disorder is power. It helps to read other people's experiences and to realize, hey, I'm not the only one going through this. And if you've read that and you think, well, all right, I'm really identifying with this, then, you know, seek out a counselor in your area, preferably someone who specializes in anxiety disorders.
Yeah, in preparation for this, I read a book called Coping with OCD, Bruce Hyman. And I'll put a link to that. Other books that you would recommend, though? The titles come to mind?
Hyman also wrote the OCD workbook, and that one is really great, especially if you've just been recently diagnosed. Another one I can think of is Freedom from Obsessive Compulsive Disorder by Jonathan Grayson. It's really good in terms of explaining exposure response prevention and cognitive behavioral therapy, which are the two main focuses used to treat this disorder. And what that entailed, writing out exactly what I was seeing. So, you know, morbid obsessions are when you think, well, what if I hurt someone? Maybe I'm going to hurt the baby. What if I hurt the baby? I'm going to hurt the baby. And you just have this thought, and you know you wouldn't do that, but it becomes this horrible fear. And so the ERP was, you have to write it out. Write out what you're seeing, and then read it, and read it, and read it out loud, and let it scare you, and be terrified. And eventually, the more you do that, it starts to affect you less. I've done it with washing. It's really tough because I want to wash my hands 45 or 50 times a day. And it's just a matter of, okay, I've got to get my hands dirty, and I have to leave them dirty. And I know it's going to scare me. But the more I do it, the more comfortable I'll become with it.
And so that's called ERP?
ERP, Exposure Response Prevention.
Yeah, that does sound tough.
A lot of inpatient programs work with it exclusively. It can be done on your own. It can be directed. Some people can't do it by themselves to start with.
Makes you anxious, right? Doesn't it make you anxious to read that or scared? Or maybe
absolutely. Yeah. The best treatment for this disorder really comes when you combine the right medications with good therapy. They can be such godsends. But it's a matter of finding the right one, you know. With any medication, it's going to be different for everyone. It can take weeks for your body to decide whether or not it likes the particular medication. It's trial and error, and it requires a lot of patience.
Well, listen, I appreciate what you've said today will help a lot of people who are either curious about it or don't understand it or have misconceptions, and those who might be wondering if it's something they ought to look into for themselves.
I'm really glad you had me on the show. Thank you so much.
All right, there you go. Again, thank you to Bobby for that very informative interview. Okay, a couple things. First is, if you want to know more about ERP, exposure and response prevention, I just ran into a really interesting podcast, and it's called Behavior Therapist, and I highly recommend it. And they just, by chance, they happen to have a recent interview with a therapist who uses exposure and response prevention. And so I really want to recommend it. The interview is by the host of the Behavior Therapist podcast, and that is R. Trent Codd. And does an excellent job with an interview with Dr. Jonathan Abramowitz, who has written a book on OCD called Getting Over OCD, 10-Step Workbook. So if you go to behaviortherapist.podbean.com, that's pod, B-E-A-N, bean.com, you'll find this. This is the February 17th episode. So I'll have a link to that as well on my website. So check that out. He talks extensively about ERP as well as other cognitive behavioral therapies. So if you're interested in that specific area of psychology, the cognitive behavioral therapies, then the Behavior Therapist podcast is one I'd highly recommend. So the research that's come out recently, here's what they're saying. Two articles, one of them in Biological Psychiatry and the other in the European Journal of Neuroscience with some very lengthy titles. One of them is Sex Differences in Neural Responses to Disgusting Visual Stimuli, Implications for Disgust-Related Psychiatric Disorders. And so that was 2007. Another one in about some of the same people in 2008. Here's the idea. I think it's really pretty interesting. Think about stuff that to you is disgusting, right? Things like, and here they mention a few. They give them like things like poor hygiene. Let's see what they call body products, which I don't want to go into what that is. Certain animals, obviously anything gory, surgery for many people, right? People faint at that, sight of blood. Deformities, another one I like called violations of the normal body envelope. Isn't it weird how we all have this thing about disgusting stuff, right? We're both attracted to it and repulsed. A couple of things come to mind. One is in my house, you know, if you cut your finger, as you know, if you listen to this, I got two kids, everybody wants to see it, right? You just want to see it. If the cats throw up, the kids want to see it. At the same time, of course, they're repulsed by it. But even think about you're driving down the highway, right? And there's an accident, that's rubbernecking there. Everybody wants to see. You don't really want to see, but you do want to see. So we seem to have this built-in attraction and revulsion for things that are a little bit, kind of disgusting. So that's an interesting observation. And what these two studies do is they take people and they put them into an fMRI, right, functional magnetic resonance imager, and they look at the activity in their brains while they present them with imagery that is both ordinary and disgusting. What do they find? They find that there is a specific area of the brain that seems to be activated while we are looking at disgusting stimuli. And that is, if you're interested, the left ventrolateral prefrontal cortex. Right? Left, so think about where this is. So it's left ventral, which means it's towards the front of your body. It's on the left side, prefrontal region. So it's sort of kind of behind your left eye, you know, maybe a little bit up. that area above your forehead and the left side of your head there. This is the area that becomes particularly active when people see things that are disgusting or even what they call contamination. They have another word for this. Contamination-related stimuli. So think about the connection here to OCD, which they make in here in the article as well, is think about the things that people with OCD do, the washing, the fear of germs, etc. Well, what this research implies is that perhaps individuals like this have a particular sensitivity, or this area of the brain is particularly sensitive to any kind of contamination or anything that seems to be out of order, anything that might be a little bit disgusting. Perhaps this part of the brain is more sensitive than other people. Really interesting articles, and as I say, I'll have links to them. Also, if you have, I have to mention this, but if you have the Psych Files iPhone app, there'll be a PDF attached to this episode so that you'll have immediate access to those articles. Come to the website as well, www.thepsychfiles.com. Don't forget the, and lots of resources there, links to some of the books that Robbie mentioned and to these articles. Lots of good stuff going on, and we are really getting a much better handle on OCD nowadays than we used to when we used to think about things like, you know, parents who are overly concerned about cleanliness, and we always blame the parents, right? but now we're getting, I think, now that we can really look inside the brain, we're getting a much better sense of where in the brain this might be occurring. And with ERP, we have some therapies appear to be, and the research is behind ERP, very effective ways of treating OCD. All right. Well, there you go. Hope you found this episode interesting, episode 117. And I just wanted to thank David Temple for the music. People have asked me what is the guitar music. DavidTemple.com. Check that out. And once again, thank you to Robbie. All right. Take care. See you next time on The Psych Files. Mm-hmm.